Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome. It is a true honor to be here with Kwame Anthony Appiah. Anthony's a professor of philosophy and law at NYU and the author of multiple books, including In My Father's House, Africa and the Philosophy of Culture, Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers, and most recently the book we'll mainly discuss today is The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity. I say we'll mainly talk about it, but I think the beauty of Anthony's work is that all these books are in conversation with each other. You may also know him as the ethicist columnist for the Sunday New York Times, where he tackles... Yeah. If as many people would buy your books as would read The Ethicist, you'd be in good business.
I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
I'd be on the side of the front.
Yeah. And he tackles questions like, I favor gun control, so what do I do with my gun? Or do I report a fellow student for plagiarism? Or now that my parents have passed away, do I tell my siblings about my mother's affair? And what I love about the column is that your answers always go beyond sort of the obvious and illuminate dilemmas and contradictions that we didn't anticipate. And that's not a terrible way, I think, to think about this book, which in some ways is a book-length ethicist column, in which you discuss the dilemmas and contradictions of identity. So there'll be time for questions at the end and certainly for book signing. But what I'd like to kick off with is the question that you raised at the beginning of the book, and you say you get a lot. What are you? Why do you get that question, and what does it make you think about when you think about your own identity?
I think in the book, and from time to time, I talk about that as a taxi driver's question. Or now an Uber driver's question, I suppose. And often it comes from a driver who is him or herself, a person of color, not a white person. And I assume that what they're checking to see is whether I might have some kind of affiliation with them. So I get this from Indians, Sikhs, not just Sikhs, all kinds of Indians. Not long ago in New York, I got it from a guy who turned out to be from Upper Egypt. And the reason this question happens to me a lot, of course, is that I am a little bit harder to place, I think, than some people. So if you look like, Rob Lowe, to pick an entirely random person, if you look like Rob Lowe and talk like Rob Lowe, people are going to assume you're a white American. And if you look like Barack Obama and talk like Barack Obama, people are going to assume you're an overeducated African American. But I'm told I've looked like this all my life. I'm kind of used to what I look like. But I'm told that that some people think I look South Asian. I once grew a beard, and my father said to me, he was ill at the time, so I went to his hospital room. I had grown a beard. He looked up at me, this is my father, and said, "You used to look like an Indian. Now you look like an Arab." That was the first thing he said to me. Anyway, and the reason the question why, I don't, as it were, look one of the regular five ways, is because I was the result of the mixing of two buckets of ancestry. One was my father's from Ghana, where I grew up, and where my sisters were born. He was from Ashanti, which is a region in the middle of Ghana. And my mother was from England, and more importantly, perhaps from her point of view, from the west of England, from Gloucestershire and Oxfordshire, that area, the Cotswolds, where she grew up on a sheep farm that her father owned. And they met in London in the 1950s. My father was a law student from Ghana, from the Gold Coast colonies it then was. My mother was working for an organization which had been started by a woman who was always called Miss Attlee, who was the sister of Clement Attlee, who was the Labour Prime Minister of England after the war, and it was called Racial Unity. And it worked to look after the interests of basically of colonial students of color in London. So they met. The details they never told us exactly of how. So something exciting must have happened. And my mother practiced what she'd been preaching. She engaged in racial unity by marrying somebody who was, by the standards of England, of a very different race. And I was born. Yes, 9 months elapsed between the wedding and the birth. So, wasn't a forced. It wasn't a shotgun wedding. And then we went to Ghana because my father finished his law degree, and that's where I grew up. So that's why I look like this. That's why I talk like this. Talk like my mother. Actually, I don't talk like my mother because I was listening. You know, everything is on YouTube, and there's an interview with my parents from the 1960s on YouTube, and I was listening to my mother, and my father talked the way I remember him talking, but my mother sounded to me like the Queen. She sounded very, very upper class, which I don't remember thinking of her way of speaking as being, and I think it must have changed as she spent more time in Ghana, but she had a very upper class English accent.
So do you say all this to the cab driver?
Now, what I usually say is, they usually say, where were you born?
Okay.
And what I usually say is, London, but that isn't what you want to know.
And then depending how long the ride is, you can get into more.
But actually, in the case of the guy from Upper Egypt, once he knew I was from Upper Egypt, he stopped talking
to me. Lost all interest, yeah.
So I told him that I asked him if he came from near Aswan, and he turned around and said, you know that Aswan is in Upper Egypt? So he was delighted to have someone who wasn't from Upper Egypt who had heard of a town in Upper Egypt.
Now, you've written about your own identity and your background and your parents. How much of your interest in writing this book was also sort of a continuing of that self-exploration?
Yeah, I mean, so the book grew out of some lectures that I was asked to give for the BBC, which were the sort of annual, that they're called the Reith Lectures. They're named for Lord Reith, who founded the BBC. And it's sort of the BBC's radio's annual kind of thought series, a big thought series. And it's also done on the World Service of the BBC, so it gets broadcast all around the world. So it had to be something that I thought would be of interest to people in a lot of different places. And we actually recorded the lectures, one in London, one in Glasgow, one in Accra in Ghana, and one in New York, with four different, you know, three continental audiences. And probably the biggest difference was the one between London and Glasgow. But because I talked about nationalism in Glasgow. So I wanted to try and talk about these things. I mean, I've tried for many years now to write books that I think that are both going to be interesting to my professional colleagues, but also might have an audience beyond that that might be useful in some other way. But this one definitely had to be like that, because of the lectures anyway, because they were 35-minute lectures for an audience of a few million people all around the world. And so I came back to things, but also started thinking about things that I haven't written about very much. So there's much more about gender in this book than in anything I've written before. That's in part because I think, because of the amount of work that's gone into thinking about gender in our society, it's actually a kind of key model for thinking about other kinds of identity. So the resources for thinking about identity that you get from particularly feminist work on gender, I think is sort of useful for thinking about other forms of identity. And at the end of the book, I talked about something which, again, I haven't said very much about directly, though it's sort of there from time to time before, which is class, which is a form of identity, which I didn't lecture on. I was only allowed four lectures, so I didn't have the fifth space which would have been necessary to do the class one. But I thought, you can't write a book about the major forms of identity in the first part of the 21st century and say nothing about class. So some of it's new stuff that I had to work out for myself, but some of it's, and all of it is very, you know, the thing about, if you write about, so the race, nation, culture, gender, class, and religion, well, I've got all of those. So there's always something, it's always going to be, to some extent, starting from where you are, which is why it's possible to tell stories about your own life in writing about these things, because everybody, not everybody has a religious identity anymore, but I was brought up in a devoutly Christian family, and with Muslim and Jewish cousins, as it happens, but still, we were, our branch was devoutly Protestant.
Now, you talk about these different sort of buckets or elements of identity. And clearly, identity and identity politics has become a very contentious and fraught discussion right now. How do you, in its sort of barest essence, how do you define identity?
I think you just need to mention three things. All identities come with labels. You have to be able to, and you don't understand an identity if you have no idea how to pin the labels on people. The second thing is that these labels are internalized by people. People identify under the labels, and so they come to think of the label, the fact that they fall under the label is giving them a reason to be in solidarity with other people who share the label, maybe to do things that are associated with the label. Maybe if you're black, you ought to be in favor of affirmative action. Maybe if you're a woman, you ought to have a concern about Me Too. I mean, there are all these things where identities play a role in thinking about, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. So that's the second thing. Labels, identification. And the third thing, and this is what makes them social, other people do things to you because of the labels. So it's not just that you do things because you're a woman or black or a cis male. People respond to you through those labels. And so those, I think, are the three essential elements. And if you think about the cases, they all have that. But then there's a thing to say about all of them, which is that they're almost always all contested. So people don't agree exactly about who's American or French. People don't agree about what follows from being French, about how you should behave. And people don't agree about how you should treat French people. So these things matter, but they matter in different and sometimes unpredictable ways.
Speaking of those ways, what are the ways in which some of the concerns you express in this book about how identity translates into political action that you feel can have certain drawbacks?
Right. So I think we all have lots of them, right, in the modern world, lots of identities. Yeah. And in politics, in different moments, different kinds of identities become salient and then dominant and then kind of the focus of shaping the big moves in political life. Mm-hmm. But in the modern world, everybody is supposed to have a citizenship. It's a Universal Declaration says that everybody has a right to a citizenship. I know that there are people who don't have it right now, but that's because we're violating their human rights. And so one identity that everybody has is going to be one associated with a state of which, at least one state, unless they're being deprived of their human rights. But within the states, organizing to get the state to do something is usually organized around other things that are not
citizenship.
Not citizenship. Almost anything but citizenship. And depending on what the issue is, of course, it can be, if you're LGBTQ, then obviously questions about the state's treatment of sexual minorities is going to be at the focus of your political life. And so you'll need to organize with LGBTQ people and with LGBTQ-friendly people in order to do something. And so your identity will be salient in that context. But then there are identities in, especially in democracies, which are organized for politics. So I'm a liberal. I'm a Democrat with a big D. I'm also a Democrat with a little D, but I'm a Democrat with a big D. These identities are, they're not just, you know, a matter of where you send checks or even just a matter of where you vote or how you vote. They have all the properties of identities. They shape your sense of, you know, who's on your side. They shape your, you can decide that somebody isn't really, you can say somebody's a Democrat in name only. You can, someone claims to be a Democrat, you can say, nope. And those identities have, in the United, when I came to the United States, I misunderstood something very important about American politics. I came in the early 80s, around the time that the Electoral College decided that Ronald Reagan would be a good thing to go with. And I remember I was living on the East Coast, and there was a woman whose name I'm not going to remember. She was a Republican, a liberal Republican senator. And she lost her seat. And I said to my friends, well, that's great. The Republican lost. And they said, did you see what the Democrat was like? And he was way to her right. And I had come from places where parties were parties of the left or parties of the right. And I was, you know, I was with the party of the left. And or you could be in the party of the center, but you couldn't be the way American parties were at that point. Well, fortunately, I didn't have to change my mind very much because America's now caught up. And we now have stopped thinking of the parties as big coalitions, complex coalitions, which include people with quite a wide range of ideological conviction. And the parties have become much more ideological, and I've watched that happen, you know, as we all have, over the last few decades. That means that the liberal and conservative and Democrat and Republican are now really powerful identities in that very psychological way. People think, oh, I can't do that, I'm a Democrat. Or I must do that, I'm a Democrat. I'm not going to go out with her, she's a Republican. And so on. You know, 30 to 60, it's one of these things where it depends on how you ask the question, but 30 to 60% of Americans don't want their kids to marry someone of the political party that they're not in. That's higher than the rate of hostility to interracial marriage. So, I mean, it's not higher than it was, but it's higher than it is. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's terrible. I mean, it's terrible for the Republic, because we're stuck with each other. We tried dividing in two once, and it didn't. It was the most bloodthirsty war of the 19th century, and huge numbers of Americans died. So we're stuck with one another, as far as I can see. I don't think a peaceful breakup's possible. So we, and even if on some days, I think there's an option. So we're stuck with one another. So we have to run the thing together, and we can't run it together with people that we think are evil, stupid, depraved, and unmarriageable. At least not marriageable to us. So we've got a challenge, and fortunately we can learn from other cases, because we've had lots of other experiences with ethno-racial identities, for example, where over time ethno-racial identities or tribal identities, which I grew up in Ghana and you know, was a big challenge in Ghanaian politics, can be overcome. The natural thing in the name of which to overcome them is the country, is the nation, is a national identity, right? That's the thing. That is, after all, the thing we're all stuck with. We're stuck with all the other citizens. And one of the interesting things, I think, about the way American citizenship works, and it's the way national citizenship often works, is Americans are mostly, whatever their left or right politics, quite attached to America. It's just that the America they're attached to is a different America. For every one of them. So yeah, we're all, you know, we can all be persuaded to wave the flag, but turns out that doesn't do a lot of good, because when we start asking, well, what's the thing, what's the content? Well, it turns out, you know, there's not enough there. So this is a sort of rambling way of getting into, you know, why I'm depressed at the moment.
Let's talk about that. The only time where the nation is sort of unambiguous is at the Olympics, right, every 4 years.
Yes. And actually, after 9/11, I think we had a moment of surprising but psychologically predictable national unity for a week or two.
So when the President of the United States says, I'm a nationalist, how do you interpret that in terms of identity? And not just whatever might be in his mind, but the way that people hear it.
There's an echo in my head of a line from a novel in which refers to someone as using what his lordship is pleased to call his mind. It doesn't matter what's going on in Donald Trump's head, I don't think, for these purposes. What matters is what happens when the president says the word nationalist. What does it do? Not what does he mean. I don't know what he means. I don't suppose he's very clear about what he means. But I think... So first of all, one thing is that it's read as... Because of the history of that term in the United States, and this is different in different places, for me, nationalism is a really good thing, because I grew up in a colony, and nationalism was what got rid of the British. My father was a patriotic Ghanaian. He was a Ghanaian nationalist, no two ways about it. He would have been willing to die for Ghana. But what it's come to mean here, I think, is a particular understanding of who we are. And that's an understanding in which there's a sort of central normative American who's white, sort of Anglo, a Protestant, or at least Christian, and so on. And
Midwestern.
And
Midwestern, perhaps.
Yes, and
non-coastal,
non-coastal.
Like you people,
yes,
right.
Yes. May have gone to college, but you know, regrets it. I mean, there's a whole set of things that sort of are invoked by that. And the main thing, though, I think, is just that it's known by the people who don't like the coastal elites that nationalism is a word that pisses us off. And that's the main reason I think the president uses much of the language he does. He just knows that people who follow him like tugging the tail of the liberal elites. So my inclination is to respond by saying, I love America too. There's good evidence that I love it more than you do, Mr. President, since you don't seem to be doing very much for it. And you're doing things that are bad for it on a reasonable estimation. So if you want to talk about loving America, I'm happy to do that. But you have to know that what you're saying is, in fact, using language that divides America. It's language that doesn't draw us together. And if we are to run the Republic together, in the end, we've got to be drawn together around some things. And he's not very... Well, he's bad at that. In fact, he seems actively to be engaged in not doing that, in trying to divide and conquer, as the Roman imperialists said. So I know that nationalism, you know, invokes the sort of image of, for him and many of his followers, kind of white nationalism, a kind of racial nationalism. And that seems to me a non-starter as a way of organizing a country as historically and currently diverse as ours. That way of organizing the country can only lead to what it led to in the 19th century. It can only lead to civil war, breakup, and death. So I'm all in favor of, as I suppose most Americans are, of, as it were, patriotism properly understood. I don't think we should shy away from that, but I think we should reject the way the president has been mobilizing it, because he knows that he's signaling
to a significant part of the population that he wants America to be a white man's country. I don't know what's going on in his head. I don't care what's going on in his head. That's the message, whatever's going on in his head. And it's a message an American president ought not to send.
Now, there are writers who are making the argument now that this particular era of American politics is affirming and deepening various kinds of identities, particularly cultural and religious identity, almost in a defensive way. Jonathan Weissman wrote a book about anti-Semitism, in which he makes that argument. A young writer named Shadi Hamid recently made that argument about his identity as a Muslim. He wrote that for most of his life he saw himself as an American who happened to be Muslim, rather than a Muslim who happened to be American. But now my identity is narrowing, and I have Donald Trump to thank for this. Do you think that the Trump era is affirming these cultural, religious, in a sense, tribal identities across the spectrum?
He's organized more against some of the tribes than others. Mm-hmm. So he has, for example, a big evangelical base, but he hasn't, as an evangelical Christian might have, mobilized against Catholics, which is a historical divide in our country going back to the great wave of northern Mediterranean, southern European migrations of the turn of the 20th century, that period. So, and the Irish, the arrival of the Irish in large numbers after the famine. So I think it's probably fair to say that, as is often the case, the forms of identity that are most mobilized by someone like our current president are the ones that feel most threatened. So Muslims, yes. Jews, yes. We've had an astonishing rise in anti-Semitic incidents in a country where 10 years ago I was asked to review a book on the history of anti-Semitism in America, and I felt a little bit that that we could say this is history. Not now. Similarly, I think, you know, LGBTQ people, especially now trans people, whom he's explicitly deprived of something, right? All those people, trans people who were serving our country in the military, he's explicitly and I think shockingly, repudiated. So I think it's going to, you know, those are the places. Obviously, if you're Latinx, the way in which he's mobilized on the southern border makes you wonder, or the way he spoke about a judge who was deciding a case that involved him, who happened to have an Hispanic-sounding name, suggests that if you're in that group, you ought to be anxious and therefore mobilized. So I think a lot of it is that. A lot of it is the kind of protective mobilization of identity that one sees when you've got political leaders, and he isn't, of course, not the only one, mobilizing, organizing somebody against these various others in order to strengthen the somebody, in order to strengthen the core team. And, you know, the great challenge of American leadership is not to do that. And, you know, he's flunking.
When you see this happening, this presents a contrast with one of the messages of your book, that identity and a lot of these realms can be very fluid.
Yep.
And sort of happen, you know, it's something that shifts back and forth over time. Even national identity,
sure.
Which we think of as monolithic, is not. Is your book then more an explanation of what you think things are really like, or is it more prescriptive, what you kind of want them to be?
I'm hoping that people can use the chapters to think about the identities that they have and that they're interested in freeing ways, so that you know, there are moments when it's not helpful to say to someone, your identity is complex, intersectional, in flux all the time, because right now they're being beaten over the head by a cop who doesn't like black people. And it's kind of an odd thing to say in that context. It
doesn't feel very fluid. It
doesn't feel
at all
fluid. And the fluidity of identity, you know, one of the theoretical points is that identities are always, they're social, they're dialogical. I don't control the full meaning of my identity. I can't. Because precisely because it is a social thing, precisely because there are things that other people think to do in virtue of my identity, and other people with whom I share the identity who may or may not agree with me about what it means for us. And so you've got to be in negotiation. And, you know, given the structures of power in the world, sometimes the only thing to do with an identity is to shore it up, solidify it, and fight with the other people on your side. So, but in a bettering world, in a world that would be is getting better, that should happen less, because that kind of negative use of identity should be it should be something that we recognize as morally wrong. And then to say to someone about any of, say, about race, look, it got to be this way starting in the 18th century, that people got divided into this way. You don't need to divide people this way. It's not an essential feature of human classification. The biologists don't find it very helpful anymore. So if we want to be lighter on the racial identity, we could be, as they were in the early 18th century in Europe, before the rise of the slave trade, or in the way that I grew up in my hometown in Ghana, where, not surprisingly, since the Guinea coast was referred to by the Europeans as the white man's graveyard because it was full of diseases like malaria that killed off an awful lot of colonists. So they didn't settle there very much. And until the invention of anti-malarials and antibiotics, you wouldn't want to come there with your family from Europe. So, you know, we knew all the white people in my hometown. My mother was one of them. And it's a town of 100,000 people. Because most people were black. So obviously, racial identity, not super salient in the lives of people there. And so, you know, it's worth knowing that there can be a place where there are people of all colors. There were Indians and Chinese and Syrians and Lebanese and Greeks in my hometown. But that was, they were basically the thing. I mean, they were foreigners by origin, but so were some of the Hausa people who were black. So I think, so one thing is just to try to get people to think, well, we're not stuck with the way we do it now, any more than we're stuck with the old ways of thinking about cis and trans. I mean, we can move if we want to, and we should move in order to shape the system so that more people are comfortable in it. The old racial system was incredibly bad for lots of people. So we needed to shift it, not by getting rid of racial categories, but by getting rid of racial inequality. But once you've gotten rid of racial inequality, maybe the racial categories can be a bit more relaxed about them. Now, we haven't gotten rid of racial inequality, so I'm not talking as if we have, but we should have the ambition to do so. And at some point in the process of developing that, it should be more up to each person to decide what weight to give to their racial identity, if any, in their lives, I think. And I think that about all these things.
You have a very unique and interesting personal cultural background that now we've heard and that scores of Cappies around the world have heard as well. One reviewer of your book said that, oh, you know, if Appiah has a blind spot, it's an assuming everyone can be as comfortably cosmopolitan as he is. Does he have a point, right? Might it be harder for other people to have this I contain multitudes kind of approach to identity?
Sure. I mean, so I'm very conscious. I think of my kind of circumstances as enormously privileged in that respect. I was also enormously privileged in other respects. I had a wonderful family. We were elite people in both the places both my mother's family and my father's family, you know, were. My great-grandfather's great-grandfather was in the British Parliament, and in that line, five other people were, including my grandfather and great-grandfather. So I understand that class has played this enormously important place in my life, and I think that's the kind of privilege that's probably the one that's made all the other stuff easiest to handle, being gay, being black in what Mr. Trump thinks is a white man's country, and so on. So I am conscious of my privilege and of the fact that that's what makes it possible. On the other hand, that makes me feel that I have a special responsibility, as it were, to point to this other possibility, this more relaxed way of thinking about identities, acknowledging that for people who are at the sharp end of certain forms of abuse and oppression, it's not helpful to them to talk about these things. Right now, what's needed is to get them out from under the oppression, not to give them some sophisticated philosophy lesson. But so, on the other hand, I have to say that I think it's false that I don't understand what I once called in a piece of writing the comforts of home, the idea of being in a place where you think of yourself as belonging, where that's you and they're us. Because I grew up in two places like that. My grandmother's village in England, which has not many people in it, you know, I spent a lot of time there as a child, and my uncle and aunt lived next door to my grandmother, and my cousins, who are my generation, and I, we grew up together. When the snow came, we slid down the lawn together on a toboggan. And my aunt was born in the village, and my great-grandfather was the MP for the town next door, so we've been there a long time. I understand all that, and the same is true, even though I grew up in a great city in Ghana, the part of the city I grew up in was a village, and those people, I know where they are. They're all over. Some of them are in Japan. The first Ghanaian to become a Japanese citizen was born across the street from me. But again, all of us have a sense of that place. So I don't think, in other words, I suppose what I'm saying is that the idea that cosmopolitans are rootless is a mistake. Some are. You can be rootless. But I don't think I am. I feel myself very much embedded in history. Last two summers ago, my sisters and I went to the village that was founded in the early 18th century by a man, one of whose names I bear, and became a sub-chief there, right? So I can give you my title if you like. So I think I feel very privileged, as I said, but I don't think that I feel privileged in a way that means I don't understand either what it's like not to be privileged or what it's like to be more embedded in a particular place, though I'm not. And I have always felt it important. So in the Cosmopolitanism book, for example, I didn't say that everybody ought to be a cosmopolitan. That's a choice you have to make. I tried to make cosmopolitanism attractive for lots of people, but I wasn't saying it's a duty. It's not a duty. You have moral duties, but being a cosmopolitan, being that kind of open to the world kind of person, that isn't a duty. You can be a perfectly morally decent human being and committed mostly to one place and its values and its people. You have to be, it's hard to be a good citizen anywhere, but it's possible without being much engaged with the thought of world citizenship, I believe. I think we need cosmopolitans, but we don't need everybody to be cosmopolitan.
You have a beef with something you call essentialism. Right, in this new book. What is essentialism, and what's your problem with it?
So, philosophers use the word essentialism in a different way from the way I do. I'm using it the way psychologists use it. They use it to mean this tendency we have, once we've got one of these labels, to think that there's some deep inner thing that explains why all the people who have the label have the label. Which means you think of them all as essentially the same, right? So, you know, there must be something in women that makes them all women. But thinking that way is going to make it less likely that you'll notice the second most obvious thing about women, than other than that they're women, is that they're incredibly diverse. And so the main problem with essentialism is it tends to make us think that there's something inside each of these kinds that, as it were, makes the members of the kind much more like each other than they actually are. And so we have kind of, and that's, you know, that leads to stereotyping, and it leads to thinking the thought that this is a normative thought, not a descriptive thought, that you can, as it were, betray the essence. You can fail to be what men are supposed to be, or what women are supposed to be, or what gay people are supposed to be, or what Americans are supposed to be. Because there's a thing in there, in the real Americans, right, that you haven't got, or that you've gotten betrayed. And so that seems to me, that's going to stop you being flexible in the ways I was just now suggesting it might be good to be flexible. But it also leads people to have thoughts that are false, mistaken. For a long time, people thought that you couldn't have women fire officers, because there was something about what women was like was somehow incompatible with doing whatever it is the fire officers are supposed to do. Well, that was just not true. There are some women who couldn't be fire officers. There are some men who couldn't be fire officers. But being a woman wasn't the explanation for why they couldn't be fire officers. It was that they weren't strong enough, for example. Maybe you have to be strong enough to lift a 150-pound person to be a fire officer. The world is full of women who can lift 150-pound people, so it's false. So I think the main problem with a lot of essentialism is just that it leads people to have beliefs about particular people that are just not right. Even if they're on average true or whatever. So it's not, I'm not denying that there are generalizations to be made. Women are on average smaller than men in height. This is true. So what? There are a lot of short men. And there's a lot of tall women. Three of them in a play of Eld Dalby's.
Is identity always going to trump? No pun. Is identity always going to overpower the kind of fluid ambiguity you're talking about? You have a line in the book that I remember where you say, the confessors of ambivalence will always seem at a disadvantage amid the fervent partisans of nativism, right? Like, are you a confessor of ambivalence? And does that make, is that inherently harder to sell and to persuade with?
I suspect so. I suspect that it's a little bit harder. But one thing that happens if you spend a lot of your life talking about these sorts of things in lots of places is that you find there are lots of people who like the proposal. It's not as if everybody's challenged by the proposal. A lot of people think, cosmopolitan. That's what I am. You just give me a name for what I was already. Or a lot of people say, yeah, what I've been feeling is that I've been forced to take to you know. I've been told that the people who've come to Christ and have been evangelical have to believe this, that, and the other. And you've told me, no, you can say you came to Christ, but also say that you believe that women should be allowed to make their own choices about what happens in their bodies, right? That's okay. That's a possibility. That's a human possibility as well. So but on the other hand, it's completely understandable that if you are in a particular country where, you know, upper middle class people, white people, straight people, as it were, have it easy, it's completely understandable that challenging as it were, the very idea of straightness, or the very idea of a ruling class, or and so on, is it might make you feel, yeah, I like things the way they are. And furthermore, it doesn't feel wrong to me. It feels absolutely right to say that I'm a man, and that there's something secondary about the way in which gay men or trans men are men. That I'm a model man. I'm the model of a modern major general, as the character says in Gilbert and Sullivan. So I understand that. And the only thing to say is, I think there are two things to say, one of which I said after explaining what identities are. One thing to say is, your manhood, your being a man, the fact of your being a man, the thing that you are claiming doesn't belong to you. Man, what it is to be a man belongs to everybody. It belongs to women and men. It belongs to gay women and gay men, and straight women and straight men, trans people and cis people. Our gender system is all of ours. And it's got to work for everybody. So you can't insist on fixing it in a place that happens to suit you if there's evidence that a significant part of your fellow human beings are screwed by that way of doing things. This is just a piece of elementary morality. These public things, and identities are public things, and remember, you know, republic is just the Latin for public things. These things belong to all of us. And if they belong to all of us, then we're only entitled to put our fair share into determining what happens, and other people's have their right too. So the first thing I'd say to someone who's sort of comfortable with the way things are is, that's not enough. That isn't. You can't say, I like it the way it is. You have to ask, does it suit everybody else that it's this way? And if it doesn't, in a decent society, you'll make the adjustments. Not quickly, because they're hard to make, but we'll make the adjustments and you'll have to come along. And the third thing I'd say is that very often the kind of sense of comfort with the dominant forms of identity, the ones that are at the top of the hierarchy, is, and I know this because I'm, you know, my uncle and great uncle were kings. I know what it is to belong to somebody who's at the top of the hierarchy. I don't understand it perfectly well. What you really like about it is that it allows you to boss people about, right? And in a democratic society, we don't endorse structures that unnecessarily allow people to boss other people about.
One of the things I enjoy about your book is that you shift from back and forth between sort of a kind of deeply individualistic look at identity and how people explain themselves. And then you kind of lay waste to these very broad categories, like Western civilization. You know, there's several books out recently about worrying about the decline of Western liberalism and the fate of the West. But you seem to feel it's not. You're not too concerned about that. You take issue with the very notion of Western civilization. What you say is that it's at best the source of a great deal of confusion, and at worst an obstacle to facing some of the greatest political challenges of our time. How does that happen in practice? How does even this notion of Western civilization, which, you know, many of us took in college, you know, Western civ, how does that present a very direct and immediate obstacle to dealing with what we have to deal with?
Well, so, you know, Kipling said, East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet. When we talk about the West, it's usually in opposition to something. So during the Cold War, it was the Soviets. Now it's increasingly something called Islam, or perhaps Islamism, if you're a little bit sophisticated. And the trouble is that if you use Western and Muslim that way, which is the one of the dominant ways that this notion is mobilized right now, you miss almost everything important about what the resources are for stopping the conflict. So, Islam itself begins in Arabia in a town full of Christians and Jews. It tells a story of the creation that is the same, essentially, as the story of the creation that Christians and Jews tell. It is their story. The prophet got it from them. The angel who dictates the Quran to the prophet is the angel Gabriel. And if you're a Jew or a Christian, you should recognize who the angel Gabriel is. Almost immediately after the creation of the first Muslim state in Baghdad, there's Mecca and Medina, but I'm talking about the great imperial state, they came to be philosophically influenced by Plato and especially Aristotle. And the word, the Arabic word for philosophy is falsafa, which is from the Greek word philosophy. There's no way of separating those people out from this thing called the history of the West, because I just mentioned Plato and Aristotle, and everybody seems to think that those are kind of important people in the history of the West. They don't stop being Western because, you know, Ibn Farabi knew about Aristotle's logic. Presumably they're... And we've been swapping stuff with them all along. The westernmost point of Islam for the latter part of the first millennium was to the west of Western Europe, right? In fact, arguably it still is, since Morocco, the western borders of Morocco are west of Ireland. So, and in Spain, and when it was Al-Andalus, when it was the Muslim under Muslim rule, there were bishops. One of the caliphs had a chief medical officer who was a rabbi. It's where Maimonides, arguably the greatest of the medieval Jewish thinkers, grew up. At the time when that place was a great mixture of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and knowledge of ancient, what we now call classics, if you showed up as a Muslim or a Jew in the capital of the Holy Roman Empire should have been in Aachen or somewhere at that point, you'd have been put to death probably. So, and later on we have in the Ottoman Empire, which is the great Muslim empire that sits on the edge of Western Europe until the 20th century. Right, they also had bishops and rabbis and so on. They also had people who knew about all this. So what am I supposed to conclude by someone who, from thinking that it's useful to contrast Western civilization and the civilization of the Muslims? I don't know. I literally have no idea what the serious proposal would be. More than that, if you say, well, by Western civilization, I mean these things that were invented in the West, democracy, liberalism, toleration, science, well...
Enlightenment values.
Enlightenment,
right?
Values.
Enlightenment values. Yes. To cover everything.
To cover
these, right?
Enlightenment values. I ask you why, if toleration is this wonderful Western invention... One of the characters I talk in my book, Sir Edward Tyler, who was the first professor of anthropology at Oxford, couldn't go to Oxford because he was a Quaker. That doesn't sound like toleration to me. And that's just a little thing, little branch off Christianity. No Jews, no Catholics, no Muslims. It wasn't even thinkable. Science, well... presupposes mathematics. Why is our word for algebra an Arabic word? So, again, I'm all in favor of science and reason and truth and love, for that matter, and toleration. But we don't have a particularly special relation to them in Europe. It was Europe who started the last two world wars. That doesn't sound like a place that's full of reason and toleration. And so I'm in favor of the ideas that people are often trying to grab when they talk about Western civilization. But if you talk about them as Western civilization, here's two things you do. First of all, you alienate other people. Instead of trying to persuade them that toleration is interesting, you tell them Western civilization is interesting. They're not Western. So I think, why should we be interested in that? Well, the answer is because it's toleration, not because it's Western. So it gets in the way of the actual thing you might want to do with these wonderful ideas, which is share them. And the second thing is, it just gets the history wrong. I just mentioned toleration, religious toleration, pluralism about religion is first practiced in Europe, in Spain under the Arabs. The next time there's anything like that that's any good is in Holland in the 17th century with the toleration of Jews. So, William of Orange went to the opening of synagogues. Great. But in the meanwhile, on the eastern wing of Europe, there was this great Ottoman Empire, where until the modern period, until it was beginning to be destroyed and turned into Turkey, it was a place which had a kind of religious toleration that was unknown in Europe. So why would you not want to be able to draw on that in order to talk about the value of toleration when you're talking to our fellow humans who are Muslim, or for that matter, our fellow humans who are Hindu or Buddhist or anything else, by sort of slapping the label Western on it, which is, as I say, A, misleading about the historical reality, and B, going to put them off.
The last thing I'll ask before we open up for questions is about a different kind of toleration. I'd be remiss at a book festival to not ask you about the intense debate over cultural appropriation in literature that we're having. There's high-profile instances of books being pulled, of publishers apologizing as a result of that kind of criticism. You write that you don't feel that cultural appropriation needs to be used, that the term should be used as an indictment, that cultural practices are sort of inherently mobile and always mixing. But then you say, those who parse transgressions in terms of ownership, right, this is my culture versus your culture, have accepted a commercial system that's alien to the traditions they aim to protect. Can you elaborate on sort of both criticisms of cultural appropriation attacks, but especially this latter point?
I think that... When you speak of cultural appropriation, you're using the metaphorical language of property, and you're essentially accusing someone of theft, of taking something that belongs to somebody else. I think that if I write a poem, I'm entitled to ask you, if you read it out loud, to say that it's mine, to say that I wrote it. But I don't think I'm entitled to tell you not to say it out loud. I think poems and novels and books like mine are meant for sharing. And so are paintings and works of music and all the other things that human imagination produces. There may be reasons for using the institutions of property to encourage creativity. That's what the American Constitution says the point of copyright is, and patent. It's to encourage the sharing of useful knowledge. And it does. Publishers need some time when they have the exclusive right to publish a book, because otherwise they do all the work of making the book, and then somebody else can just photocopy it and sell it and, you know, undercut what the publisher has done. And if you haven't, you know, some people, maybe there are people in this room who haven't actually published a book. The moment between when you finish with it and the publisher finishes it, there's a lot of work goes on. It's the idea, which you can tell actually, because now people can publish their own books on Amazon. Many of them are, you know, you can see why publishers are a good idea. So I don't, you know, of course, and if you have a reasonable system of copyright, which we don't, we have an absurd system of copyright which allows copyright to last much too long, but that's a separate topic. But if you have a reasonable system of copyright, then if you violate it, you are stealing something. So that's bad. But it isn't bad because you're sharing ideas or moving them around. It's just bad because there's a reasonable system of property which doesn't allow you to do it that way. You have to pay a small amount of money to do that, to take a copy of a poem or something. So I'm really, if you just think about the stuff we care about, the kind of people who go to book festivals, imagine Tolstoy without any French stuff. How do you tell War and Peace if you're not allowed to mention anything from French culture? Just go reread it and imagine what happens. Just every time something French comes up, like, for example, the name of one of the central characters is Pierre. Imagine just saying, oh, I can't read that page because this is Russian cultural appropriation of French stuff. I gave the example in the last panel, which was because it's one of my favorite, of Basho, right? Kazuo Basho, great Japanese poet, haiku master. He's a Buddhist. That's cultural appropriation of Indian religion. He's using a script. Where did the script come from? Oh, it's Chinese. Cultural appropriation of Chinese intellectual property. I mean, Shakespeare can't write Hamlet because it's about a Dane. He can't write Julius Caesar because it's about a Roman, or Coriolanus. I just think it's a sort of, you know, Picasso can't be inspired by a Vili sculpture, as he was at the beginning of Cubism, because it's an African thing. It's a Vili thing. So if you aren't Vili, you shouldn't be able to be inspired by it. You should, if you're Yoruba, you shouldn't be inspired by it. This is craziness to me. So having said all that, however, those mistakes come from thinking of this as stuff that's owned. But of course, when things are owned, you shouldn't steal them. When things are reasonably owned. So, if you make a lot of money in a world music, but you don't share any of it with the people you got the music from, that's bad. That's a kind of theft. It may be legal. It's a kind of theft. That's bad. But that's because you're taking something from someone who doesn't have the power to negotiate with you reasonable terms of cooperation. That's exploitation. That's bad. Similarly, using certain kinds of things, certain, for example, American Indian rituals, which have a kind of significance for the people who do them, which mean that they don't want other people doing them. Using those, that's disrespectful. It's disrespectful not because you took something. It's disrespectful because you didn't pay attention to what it was that you were taking and what it means to take it. So I think I can think of lots of cases where things go on that I would disapprove of under the rubric of cultural, that are challenged under the rubric of cultural appropriation. But I don't think in any of them the key issue is the wrongness of somebody of one identity using something made by somebody of another identity. I think that's never in itself wrong. Nor is it sensible, in my view, to try to imagine a literary world in which you're only allowed to talk about yourself or people who share your identity. I don't know what that... I mean,
I know a lot of writers who...
Well, exactly. And what do we think of them? What do we think of them? I mean, so the background picture just seems to me a wrong picture. So I want to be heard both as saying that and as saying, of course, there are lots of abuses, cultural abuses in the world, and the heart of most of them is one of two things: disrespect or exploitation. And disrespect and exploitation are certainly wrong. But Shakespeare wasn't disrespecting the Danes by taking an old Danish story to make a play. And obviously, Basho isn't disrespecting Buddhism by living the life of a Zen Buddhist. He's precisely respecting Buddhism, even though his Buddhism isn't the Buddhism that started out in India. He's changed it. I mean, not on his own. Japan has changed it. And so, and China changed it before it got to Japan. So, you know, there's a way in which some Indian Buddhists might be upset with what the Zen Buddhists have done with Buddhism. They might say, that's not what we sent you. just as lots and lots of Christians in Europe and North America don't like what some of my fellow Africans have done with Christianity. And I say, too bad.
So before you all dash home to read War and Peace, reread War and Peace. Yeah, I mean, so. Clearly, we have time for a few questions. Is there? Yes.
Okay. I'm just really interested in what insights you might have. Good, the problem with identities that perceive each other as a threat, which is the part of our kind of situation where you really have two groups of people who've been victims and oppressed in very, very different ways who perceive each other as a threat when the real threat is something up above. So.
It might be good to take the microphone because I want to ask you something, and I just want to make sure I understand what you're talking about.
Sure, yeah.
What are the two groups you're talking about? Because there's lots of groups in our society that seem to regard each other as a threat. What did you have in mind?
I think just to orient myself to you, historically. Back from slavery, the black population in this country used as slaves and horribly oppressed. And then the problem of also a whole population of poor whites, which were working class and also exploited and also manipulated all the way along from the end of slavery through Reconstruction on up by the power that had the money and the wealth, and that both of those groups were oppressed in different ways, and they tragically can't see how, you know, they have something in common that actually could be used against the bigger threat.
Good. I just wanted to make sure that I understood what the case was you were thinking about. I mean, so this was one of W.E. Du Bois's great insights in his book on Reconstruction, which was that essentially the new form of racism that was developed, or the extension of racism after the Civil War in this country, was in part, he thought, organized around essentially a mechanism for dividing the working class. He didn't quite put it that way in that book because he wasn't yet a member of the Communist Party. But that's his final analysis, is that racism, at least in this context, in the United States context, it has been a mechanism for dividing the working class. And, you know, he would point to things like the fact of Henry Ford's support for black churches in Detroit, so that when he was dealing with striking white unions, he could bring in black scabs. Because there wasn't solidarity between the white and the black workers, they couldn't hold solidarity against each other. So, all right. I think there must be some truth in that story. I think it's much more, the reality is very much more complicated than that. But there's still an element of truth in it. I think there's also an important truth in the fact that if you were the part of the working class, which was white but also some black, that did well in the heyday of solid industrial working jobs in the car industry, steel industry, and so on, where you had a job that was going to last your career, you were going to move up slowly, you had a strong union that was negotiating good wages, you had union halls where you socialized with other workers in the business, in your enterprise. And you had the sense that you were participating in something of which you could be proud. You were making cars that went out into the world and were valued by people, not just in the United States, but in other places. That sense of, as it were, the good working job, the good blue-collar job, which around which you could organize a really decent life. You could afford a mortgage, you could have a car, you could hope that your children would not just finish high school, but some of them would go to college. And so all of that, right, has gone away for a significant part of the population. And at the same time, our public discourse has not really talked enough about that, and has talked enough, not enough, has talked about challenges for black people, and challenges for trans people, and challenges for women, in a way that makes them feel, well, you're not talking about us. We have problems too. And furthermore, if you talk about those other things in a way that accuses them of being racist, sexist, homophobic, and transphobic, you're not really encouraging exactly the shared sense that we have shared problems to meet. That you ought to be. That's the only way, you know, we can make progress on these things. I think that if I were to begin the list of the things that I think our political elite has most failed on, I would say it's a bipartisan failure to pay serious attention to that problem, which is going to get worse because of automation. Now, unfortunately, some of the blame, instead of focusing the blame on the failure of anybody to think seriously about what you do as the economy changes in this way, which involves public policy, economic decisions by corporations in the state and so on, instead of doing that, people have encouraged the people who have been suffering most about this to focus on another way in which their jobs have been replaced, which is by the transfer of jobs abroad. So then you can use the normal mechanisms of identity to demonize the Chinese, the Mexicans, whoever it is that you want to demonize this week, in order to distract attention from the real problem. It's not actually bad for most Americans that those jobs have gone to China, right? If they hadn't gone to China, I wouldn't have an iPhone, because I wouldn't be able to afford it. And if I wouldn't be able to afford it, most people wouldn't be able to afford it, because I'm a prosperous fella. So we haven't done a good job of explaining what's really going on. And part of the reason we haven't is because the damage that was done in the post-industrial part of our country, especially in the middle, was something we could have done something about. Because the net effect of automation and transfer of jobs overseas has been to create trillions of dollars of new wealth. What we didn't do was share it. In particular, we didn't share it with the people who were the most victimized, victimized isn't the right word, who suffered the most. We didn't mean to victimize them. It wasn't the point of the exercise, wasn't it? So victimization isn't quite the right word. But they bore the brunt of it. And now, I am deeply not opposed to, for example, the globalization of the labor market, because that's why in the last couple of decades, hundreds of millions of human beings have been taken out of poverty. You cannot, as a decent person, I think, be opposed to that. It could have been done better, but and especially the profits could have been shared more fairly in both ends, in China and here. But, and both China and the United States have seen huge increases in inequality over the last 20 years, so, you know, this is not just us. But we have put no cultural and intellectual effort into thinking about. We've put some literary effort. There are good novels about as well what's happening in these communities, but it isn't the job of the novel to solve the problem. It isn't the job of the novel to tell us, okay, this is bad, so, you know, novels shouldn't end with policy prescriptions.
Good ones shouldn't end.
Good ones, yes. So I think I mean, I agree with you, and I think we should be clear that the... So I have... I know people who blame something called capitalism. But these things have to be done by people. And capitalism isn't a person. So we have to think about, how did this happen? Why haven't we had the conversations that made it absolutely clear that terrible things were going on in parts of our country and other countries that we were doing nothing about, while we were creating all this wealth, which we could have used to do something about it?
I think we can sneak in one last quick question. I don't know where the mic is. Oh, he's already... Sorry.
Hi. I want to thank you, Professor, for your precision and the care with which you parse through things that are really muddy and difficult and confound most of us all the time. In that vein, there are many people here in this audience. Berkeley is a sort of hotbed of people who might agree with your prescription or at least advisement to be cosmopolitan and engage in the world and be different. And people like us, who it comes to us naturally by dint of our parentage, but then most Americans who are white just associate with white people. And educated people of color associate with white people and other people of color. But though there's so many people who would buy your book and come to events like this, mostly white people, most of their lives remain white. And I believe that that's a sort of barrier, and it creates intractability in terms of actually changing circumstances, whether from a material point of view or a social point of view. So if you could just speak a little bit about your, I mean, you teach at NYU, so and you probably live in a world where most of the people are white, and then there's you. So just what are your thoughts and feelings or hopes about all that?
Thank you. That's a good short question. I'm not sure it has a good short answer, but first of all, one of the joys of teaching at NYU is that my students are diverse. We have lots and lots of first generation students in our undergraduate body. We have students from all over the world. I've never taught a seminar at NYU, and I only teach seminars, and they tend to have 20 to 25 people in them, in which there weren't three or four people whose first language wasn't English. That's great for me. And that's part of the building of cross-identitarian trust and social capital that you're talking... This is my weird way of talking about that. I think one of the most important thoughts in social psychology is what's called the contact hypothesis, which was invented by Gordon Allport, who was a man who wrote about prejudice in the 1950s, beginning in the 1950s. And his thought was this, this was an empirical claim, that if you do things together across identities, he was an American, he was thinking about race, but it's a generalizable point. If you do things together across identities where you work on terms of rough equality, on something that matters to both of you, where you depend upon one another, then bigotry goes away or doesn't start. But it has to be on terms of rough equality, and it has to be on something that's meaningful for both of you. We need to be finding in our society opportunities to do that across conservative, liberal, across black, white, and so on. I think. Used to be that you could imagine churches and temples and synagogues doing this, and some of them do, but increasingly we have a society where lots of people don't go to any of those, and so we need to find other places, I think, to do it. I don't know how to imagine those places, and making places that are, as it were, aimed at this kind of good is probably going to produce boring places. So you've got to figure out how to do it in a way that's not boring. And I don't know that I'm up for that. But at least I can give you this analysis and suggest to all of us that we should be thinking about ways to do that, because I think the contact hypothesis is true. I mean, when people talk about Muslims in the abstract to me, I think about my cousins, Lena and Randa, who are Muslims, and I went to Eid with them throughout my childhood. If you start railing against the Jews, I think about the Seder that I have every year with my Jewish husband. It's just very hard to sustain certain kinds of prejudices if you're deeply hanging out with people who are in various ways different from you. Because of what I said about class, I should say that I think class is another of the great barriers in our society. And again, our religious institutions used to do some of the work, but now a lot of megachurches are kind of class-based and rather than community-based. And so on. So this is, I'm not cheering you up, I'm sure. I'm suggesting an analysis which at least identifies an approach that I think is genuinely, could be genuinely made to work. But it would be work. I mean, we'd have to put some of our social time into these sorts of things because we thought it was worthwhile. And I think the state of the republic suggests that it's urgent that we build these links of trust.
Please join me in thanking Anthony Appiah.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.